answer immediately, she began to worry that her mom could be standing in the kitchen dining area that overlooked the back patio. She tapped the code to the pool house into the keypad alongside the door, then stepped in when it unlocked.
Sean?
She called out through the den and then again up the stairs. It was weird he wasn't up, but she knew her dad gave him Wednesdays and Sundays off. It was Wednesday, so she figured he was just sleeping in. Charlotte didn't go upstairs to where Sean slept. That would be weird, she decided, so she texted him that she was here, then headed through the pool house to the storage room in the back. There, she quietly dressed in her wetsuit, picked out a surfboard for today's excursion, and began collecting other odds and ends she'd need for a morning at the beach. Three Mercedes-Benz G550 SUVs rolled down the driveway in front of Kenneth Cage's Hollywood Hills mansion, then parked in a line in front of the house. A pair of Sean Hall's men climbed out of the first vehicle, unlocked the door, and, while keeping their hands over the pistols secreted under their polo shirts and light sport coats, they scanned the area. Seconds later, one of them called into his radio, and all the doors to all the SUVs opened as one. Eight other men and two women, Roxana Vaduva and Dr. Claudia Riesling, climbed out and headed inside. Everyone in the entourage had a mission this morning, and Yako had tasked one of Hall's men, much to Hall's disapproval, to be in charge of Maya. He took her by the arm into the large kitchen at the rear of the house and sat her down at a table in front of the sliding glass door overlooking the pool and rear gardens, while he went looking for some cordage to tie her with. He bound her tightly with an electrical extension cord but didn't bother securing her to the chair because he didn't want to deal with untying her from an object if they had to make haste to the SUVs. Still, the girl he only knew as Maya was utterly compliant, so he wasn't worried about her running off. Sean Hall's six security men took up positions around the home, their eyes cast out on the sharp hills and massive homes all around. Hall started to run over to his pool house for a change of clothes. He was still wearing an undershirt and jeans, but he'd only made it into the kitchen before Cage yelled from the living room, demanding that Hall, Verdorn, and Lutz follow him into his office to begin removing incriminating files and computer drives. Sean turned to comply with his boss's wishes, but on his way out of the kitchen, he called across the room to his subordinate. "Don't just sit there, Scott. Make us a pot of coffee." Claudia headed to the kids' rooms after Cage directed her to a stack of suitcases in a hall closet. Within 5 minutes of arrival, the director and his people were all over the house, hurrying through their assignments, while a few miles away, the pilots of the Gulfstream waited at LAX after filing a flight plan for San Jose, Costa Rica.
"It's just after 7 a.m. when we park next to an unused warehouse just outside the fenced-in grounds of Van Nuys Airport. We sit down at picnic tables along a chain-link fence, just 25 yards from where Carl's bullet-pocked helicopter is parked on a pad at the end of the runway. We drink coffee and clean and rebandage Kareem's arm wound, in that order. Carl and AJ talk about Shep's dog, agree to share custody and take care of her now that her master is unable to do so. And then we sit around, just hoping for a bolt out of the blue. We know we can't count on Roxana, so our only fallback plan is to scan the news on a couple of the guys' mobile phones, reading updates about the gun battle a few hours earlier, a half hour's drive to the north of our position. We're hoping against hope that the media will be able to tie someone to the property or to one of the dead there, as much of a long shot as that seems. We also pull out binos and scan the airport grounds, on the off chance the director is flying out of this airport. It's a 100-to-1 shot, which demonstrates how desperate we are. My phone rings and I answer it in my earpiece. Talissa? The Romanian Europol analyst's voice conveys a sense of dread.
Harry, it's him. He's on the line. He says he will kill Roxana.
Patch him through. I hear some clicks and then I say, "That you, Yako?"
His dark voice replies,
"Nice work last night."
I laugh. It's phony, but I want to appear relaxed and in control.
"You like that shit, do you?"
"Love it. I thought you'd sneak in, your standard operating procedure."
Figured you'd kill a couple Mexicans with a stiletto before my guys came across you and did you in. But no, you went big, didn't you? Made a lot of noise, broke a lot of things, killed some people who didn't matter. We slayed a lot of your boys, didn't we? Maybe. But what did you get out of all that? I recovered a house full of sex trafficking victims, all of whom can identify the people who... Nobody's identifying a bloody thing, mate. Those whores will be useless to you. We're protected at the highest levels. You're pissing into the fucking wind. I don't respond. He then says, I was just telling your girlfriend on the phone that I've got her little sis here with me, in the next room. I'm thinking about walking over there and sticking my knife through her heart. What's the gray man going to do about that? I don't have to do anything about that, because you aren't going to touch her. He laughs. Oh, yeah? Why is that? Because the only reason you took her away from the ranch last night was that you know she's your failsafe, your last chance to bargain to save yourself, save your boss. He pauses for a long time, and then he says, Gentry, I'm going to tell you something about me. I sigh. Knock yourself out. I was South African military, 4th Special Forces Regiment. As a Riki, I saw action in the Congo and in the Central African Republic, plus some other shit I'm not talking about. Good, because I couldn't care less. Yako sniffs out a short laugh. My point is, when I left the military, I went into intelligence. For 3 years, I chased down every gray man sighting or potential gray man sighting in Africa. A couple of hunts in the Middle East, others on the Indian subcontinent. Hell, I even went to Bangladesh on a lead. Yeah, I say. Never been to Bangladesh. He acts like he doesn't hear me. But intel work was a fucking bore. No gray man, no action, no test of the metal like I'd gotten in my 20s as a Riki. To this I say, any chance I could get you to tell me why you called? Another laugh from the South African, but I can tell in his voice he's stressed. He ignores me again and keeps up his story. No other options for a bloke like me but to go into corporate security. I thought it would be tiresome and monotonous, but it was even so much worse than that. So when my company was contacted by a corporation in the consortium, when I started getting the full picture of what this is all about, when me and my boys started working tough, demanding jobs to keep this entire bloody enterprise afloat, I was like, yeah, that's more like it. You're a piece of shit. You know that, right? He ignores the comment and continues. I love my job, Gentry, is what I'm saying. But now I'm up against you. The one prize I've wanted for years and years. Can't believe how lucky I am that you got drawn into this whole thing. I shake my head at this. I bet Kostopoulos and Bobbick wouldn't consider themselves lucky. Does the director know you see my arrival in California as a positive turn of events? Now Yako laughs maniacally into the phone. I see the glasses half full. The director wouldn't get it. He's not like us. Not a huntsman. He likes his food caught and cleaned and carved and served to him on a china plate. You and me, on the other hand, we don't care about the dish. We only care about the art of the pursuit, the thrill of the kill. You're right about that. So why don't you let Roxana go, and then you and I can hunt each other into oblivion? Nice try. But if you got your girl back, I can't be sure you wouldn't just slip away, gray man style. No, mate. I need the lamb on the steak for the lion to come for it. You've told your boss she's a bargaining chip, but that's not it, is it? You are holding on to her so that I keep coming for you. Yako says, bingo. AJ hands me a cup of coffee from the McDonald's on the corner, and I take a swig. Normally, I would benefit from the caffeine almost immediately, but this asshole has me so amped, I have plenty of energy. I say, I'm going to be on top of you soon. My face in your face, while your life is leaving you through a hole in your chest. And, as you're bleeding out, I'm going to ask if you're still so happy to have me chasing you.
Keep telling yourself that, Gentry. It will bring us closer.
Almost to himself, he says, I love my job. I'm tired of this testosterone-infused back and forth, but I'm trying to get something out of him I can use.
He seems to think I'm going to appear in front of him any minute, but the truth is, I've only got his boss narrowed down to an area some 100 miles in diameter. But before I can try to pull intel out of him, he says,
Until that day, Court.
And then the line goes dead. Shit. As the bodyguard worked on pulling coffee mugs out of a cabinet and pouring milk into them, Roxana looked out the window at the back of the property and thought it looked like images she'd seen of Versailles. The pool, the marble deck, the foliage and setting. It was idyllic. 9102 Jovnita Canyon Drive.
What a strange place for the devil to live, she thought.
She'd seen the address on the way in. All she had done as they drove was to try to find street signs, notable buildings, and other things that would help her direct her sister to her, should the opportunity arise. But while pulling into the drive, they stopped a moment for the gate to open, and right in front of her, she saw the street address on the massive mailbox. If she had harbored any lingering doubts that she would be killed by her captors, they disappeared when she realized no one around her had any qualms about her knowing exactly where the director lived. She knew she was a dead woman now. There was not a shred of doubt about it. But she still held out faint hope that she could reach out to her sister before she died. On the walls around her in the kitchen, she saw pictures of the director, a man she now knew was named Ken, and his family. A girl of about 15 stood with her younger brother and sister in one. They all held oars and life preservers in front of a swiftly moving mountain stream as they smiled at the camera. In another, the same kids, younger, stood lined up back to front on skis with an impossibly gorgeous snow-capped mountain chain in the background. Her eyes drifted back out to the rear of the property, and she was surprised by a hint of movement through the sliding glass doors to her right. There, on the first story of a detached white two-story building covered in vines next to the pool, she saw a brown-haired girl pass in front of a window. Not once, not twice, but repeatedly. The girl seemed to be carrying items back and forth, appearing and then disappearing from view. She was the right age to be one of the girls Roxana had seen along the pipeline over the past 2 weeks, but this one didn't look familiar to her. The foreign man watching over her poured coffee in cups and insulated tumblers, draining the pot. As he finished, one of the South Africans entered the kitchen.
We don't have time for that, mate.
Your boss isn't my boss, and my boss says to get some coffee and his men. Watch the merch while I pass these around the house.
The man Roxana had heard referred to as Lion 2 sighed.
Got any left for me?
Be my guest. The bodyguard grabbed 4 mugs and started out of the kitchen. On his way into the living room, he looked back to the South African. She's tied up. Just don't let her go anywhere.
Hurry it up then.
The bodyguard left the room, and the White Lion operative grabbed himself a cup, then began to take a sip. Just then, Verdorn came out of the library hanging up his phone. He had a smile on his face.
Where's the guard?
Lutz rolled his eyes as he said,
Delivering coffee to Hall and Cage.
Verdorn asked,
Is she tied?
Referring to Maya across the room at the table, her hands behind her.
Yeah, boss, Lutz said. Okay, come with me. We'll start hauling shit to the cars. You gonna be a good girl and sit right there?
He asked Roxana as he walked. She nodded without speaking, and he left the kitchen. As soon as they disappeared, Roxana looked around frantically for a telephone, and she found one across the kitchen table on a cradle. This gave her a moment of optimism, though she had no idea how the hell she could possibly dial her sister's number, country code and all, with her hands tied behind her back. But then she turned her attention to the pool house, where she'd caught glimpses of what she took as a young trafficking victim through the window. That girl had clearly not been bound, and Roxana wondered if she could make it out back the screen door, across the pool deck, and inside the pool house without being detected. She knew she had to try,
She looked quickly back over her shoulder to make sure no one was approaching from behind. Then she rose, shot across the kitchen, spun around, and used her hands behind her back to unlock and slide open the glass door. She shut it behind her, then ran as fast as she could in her stocking feet to the pool house. Once there, she turned around again, felt blindly until she grasped the door latch, opened the unlocked door, and stepped inside. On her left, she saw the open kitchen, so she stepped to a counter, found a paring knife on a cutting board, and carefully cut the ties, lashing her wrists together. When this was done, she looked down at the knife in her hand. It was a weapon, but she knew she couldn't fight her way out of here. She thought about using it to kill herself, but only for a moment. No, she wasn't doing that. Roxana was on a mission, and the mission was to find a damn phone. A noise startled her, and she looked up to find the girl she'd seen through the window, now walking through the living room. She wore a purple wetsuit, unzipped at the waist, with the arms hanging down by her legs. On her body, she wore a black long-sleeved rash guard, and she had handmade bracelets on both wrists. Roxana had seen dozens of sex trafficking victims, none of them dressed like this. The girl saw her, stopped, and stared, obviously confused.
"Do you speak English?"
Roxana asked breathlessly.
Yeah? Who are you?"
The girl spoke with an American accent, and this Roxana found bizarre. There had been no American slaves at the ranch, and certainly none in the pipeline. Roxana began to answer, but the American asked,
"Are you a friend of Sean's?"
Roxana just looked at her before saying,
"He brought me here. My name is Roxana."
"Hi,"
the girl said awkwardly. In the quiet that followed, Roxana suddenly realized she'd seen this girl before, moments ago in the photos in the kitchen of the director's house. She had been younger then, but she was the oldest of the three kids pictured on the ski slope.
"What is your name?"
Roxana asked in disbelief.
"Charlotte Cage."
"You are Ken's daughter?"
The young girl nodded nervously, like she'd been caught doing something wrong. She said,
"Sean and I were supposed to go surfing this morning. I guess he forgot. Look, I'm not supposed to be here. I mean, I'm supposed to meet Sean, but my mom told me not to come home.
Will you do me a favor and—"
"I won't say anything, but your father is over there in the house right now."
Charlotte looked out the window.
"Shit,"
she said again.
"Stay here. I'll tell Sean where you are, and when they are finished with what they are doing, you guys can go surfing."
Charlotte looked relieved.
"Thank you. Please don't tell my mom and dad."
Roxana looked at her a moment more, then asked,
"You wouldn't happen to have a phone I can borrow, would you? I need to send a quick text."
Charlotte cocked her head.
"Who doesn't have a phone?"
She reached into the waistband of her wetsuit and pulled out an iPhone. 60 seconds later, Roxana moved back up the pool area, rewrapping the loose cord around her wrists behind her back as she did so, and tucking the ends in so it looked like she was still bound. She'd just finished when the sliding door opened and the American guard who'd stepped away with the coffee lurched out, grabbed her by the throat, and yanked her back into the kitchen, leaning into her ear as he did so. Softly, so no one else in the house could hear, he said,
"Where the fuck did you go, you bitch?"
Roxana stared back at him, and she answered in a low tone herself.
"I was looking for a bathroom."
"Outside?"
"Yeah, outside. I thought there would be one in the pool house and I could get some privacy, but the front door was locked."
"You weren't out there a second ago."
"I tried going around back, but I couldn't get in. My hands are tied up, remember?"
The bodyguard stared at the pool house a moment, then shoved her back down into her chair. He searched her thoroughly, but she had done a good job with the cord, so he didn't pick up on the fact she was no longer securely tied. He began pacing around the kitchen in a panic, but said nothing until the South African who'd been watching her passed by in the hall with a load of files in his hands. Quietly, but with unmistakable anger, the American said,
"Hey, you were supposed to watch her. She went outside."
The White Lion operative looked at Roxana, then back at the bodyguard.
"No, mate, you were supposed to watch her. I thought you had her lashed to the bloody chair. But did you search her when you got her back?"
"Yes, she's clean."
"Then what's your worry?"
He started moving off, then looked back to her.
"We'll keep this to ourselves. We'd both get an ass kicking."
The American nodded.
"Right,
Okay. The South African disappeared on his way to the SUVs parked out front. As he paced back and forth, the protection officer tasked with watching Roxana raised his hand to strike her twice, but both times he lowered it before hitting her. Finally, he just sat down in front of her, his hand fingering the butt of his pistol in his shoulder holster, and he stared at her with pure malevolence, but Roxana didn't care. She felt better now. Yes, she would probably die today. But it didn't matter now, because before she left Charlotte Cage hiding in the pool house, Roxana had used the teen's phone to send a very short but very informative text to her sister. 9102 Jovanita Canyon Drive. Director is Ken Cage. 10 men with guns here. Whatever happens, I love you. Do not reply. And then she'd return to the main house. Roxana knew that if she escaped, Cage and the others would flee the property immediately. No, she had to wait to buy time for Talissa, even if waiting meant dying. 53. I disconnect the call with Talissa, repeat the address she just gave me out loud, and then Rodney types it into Google Maps on his phone. Even before it comes up, he says, "Jovanita Canyon? That's up in the Hollywood Hills." We look at the satellite map, zoom in on the place, and see a large Italianate mansion that looks like it must be worth $50 million. The property is positioned on a steep hill, the grounds around it are meticulously sculptured, and a detached pool house looks like it's twice the size of the home I grew up in. AJ says,
"We're really gonna hit a mansion in Hollywood? Cops will be all over the place. If the bad guys don't get us, then 5-0 will."
Carl adds,
"LAPD helicopters fill the skies down there. I can insert you boys, but it will be a one-way trip for all of us."
Both men are right, of course. With a shrug, I say, "I'm going in, with or without you guys." Kareem chuckles a little as he fingers the bloody bandage on his shoulder.
"Settle down, hero. You ain't the only dude here that wants to do the right thing."
He looks at Carl and his two surviving teammates.
"For Shep, we're gonna see this to the end."
Carl, AJ, and Rodney agree.
The wiry Vietnam vet starts walking over towards the helicopter now. "We're skids up in 3 minutes, fellas."
AJ, Rodney, Kareem, and I turn back to the satellite image, and we all get to work on making a hasty plan to hit the mansion. 14 minutes later, the last of the bags were loaded into the Mercedes SUVs. Cage grabbed a small framed photo of him and his entire family off his desk and carried it in his hands through the expansive foyer towards the front door. Both Jaco Verdoorn and Claudia Riesling moved along with him, and Sean Hall walked just a couple of steps behind, next to Maya, who was being led by one of his men. Hall pulled his phone out and checked the time, and when he did so, he realized he'd missed a text from Charlotte. In a sudden panic, he remembered he'd agreed to take her surfing this morning, but quickly he relaxed, knowing that her mom had told her to stay well clear of the house. But when he tapped the text to look at it again, the panic returned.
"Oh, shit," he said,
and he slowed, then stopped. Charlotte was waiting for him right now back at the pool house. Cage kept walking with the rest of the group nearing the front door. Hall started to call out to his employer, but then he turned his head at a faint noise. Helicopters are common in the skies over Los Angeles, so no one in the entourage paid any attention to the thumping rotor sound, till it echoed louder than usual along Jovanita Canyon Drive, bouncing off the higher hills in front of the house and rolling in from all directions. Cage stopped at the front door, Hall's men around him, Jaco standing at the director's side. Sean was frozen in place at the grand entry hall of the mansion, recognizing that the helo was low. It was racing closer, and it was right now shooting over the rear of the property. Then the helicopter flew over the mansion itself, towards the front of the home, its rotor noise vibrating paintings on the walls. Verdoorn reached out and grabbed Cage by the shoulder and brought him back away from the door, then leaned back out and looked for the source of the thunderous noise. There was nothing in front of him but Hollywood Hills and mega mansions, but then a red helicopter suddenly shot over his head, not 50 feet in the air. He'd not seen the aircraft that attacked the night before at Rancho Esmeralda, but this one sounded identical to him. He reached for his waistband, and as he pulled out his HK pistol, several small objects, each the size of a soup can, bounced right in front of him on the drive between the front door and the row of Mercedes SUVs. Red smoke poured from the canisters as they bounced on the stone drive, billowing quickly in all directions. Verdorn started shouting orders, Cage's men began rushing forward, and Sean watched 25 feet away through the growing cloud of red smoke while the helo pulled up steeply and transitioned to a hover over the steep front drive. Bodyguards and White Lion men raised weapons to shoot at it, but rifles began barking from inside the helicopter, so the men abandoned their counterattack and sought cover. One of Sean's men was already outside the home on the other side of the row of three Mercedes. He fired on the threat with his handgun but was cut down by rifle fire before he got a second shot off. And then the smoke became too thick to see the chopper hovering over the driveway. Verdorn yanked Cage down onto his back in the foyer and rolled him away, while Diker, one of Verdorn's two surviving operatives, took a round through the forearm and tumbled back, writhing in agony as blood spurted from him. Sean and his men had pistols and submachine guns. Lutz had a rifle, but no one dared return to the doorway. Instead, some men took up positions in windows in the front room and the library, eyes peering around walls, searching for a target in the impenetrable red smoke, while Hall and others ran forward to get to Cage so they could move him to safety. 2 minutes ago, Carl dove his AS-350 towards sea-level Hollywood, then turned the nose away from the downtown L.A. skyline and back towards the Hollywood Hills. He followed the incline, low and fast, towards the rear of Cage's mansion on Jovanita Canyon Drive. AJ and I stood outside the cabin on the starboard side, with Rodney and Kareem opposite us on the portside skids. Carl nearly caught a set of power lines with the skids on the ingress, and a few seconds after this, I was certain we were going to plow into a glass and steel luxury home. We missed the flat roof by 5 feet, and then I saw the target location right in front of us, higher on the hill. I reached into the cabin of the Hilo with both hands, letting my rope lifeline hold me there, my boots on the skids. From a cardboard box, I retrieved a pair of M18 smoke grenades and pulled the pins one by one, and thick red smoke burst from the bottom of each. Seconds later, we rocketed over Cage's infinity pool, and I dropped both M18s as close as I could to the back door of the home before flying over the roof. I didn't look to see where they landed because I was already reaching back into the helo, as were all four men on the skids, and we quickly pulled out one more grenade each, yanked pins, and dropped them at the very front of the house as we passed above it. No more than a second or two after releasing, Carl spun the helicopter violently on its axis 180 degrees, then lowered us down closer to the driveway. We looked towards the front door and saw men there. Both AJ and I were on the side of the helo with a sightline towards our enemy, so both of us fired a few rounds at targets. AJ dropped an armed man in a polo standing next to three black Mercedes G-wagons, and I think I hit a man pointing a weapon at me in the doorway before the targets disappeared. Carl was pulling off a tricky maneuver getting us so close to the earth due to the steep downgrade of the driveway. We knew from the first glance on Google Maps that he wouldn't be able to land without striking a rotor against the cement, but he hovered about 4 feet above ground. His eyes locked onto his outboard rearview mirror, his spinning rotor within a foot of striking, which could cause it to disintegrate and, no doubt, kill all of us. The other three men unfastened their carabiners and dropped the last few feet, blunting their impacts by collapsing on their legs when they landed. I know their ankles and knees and hips and backs will have something to say about their decision soon enough, but I was relieved to see all three men adjust their packs and their rifles and begin moving, albeit slowly and uncomfortably, forward towards the Mercedes SUVs. Now the Eurocopter launches higher into the air as it spins to the right, then begins shooting back towards the house. I'm still outboard on the skid, but I reach for my carabiner and hold it with my left hand while my right keeps my Kalashnikov on my shoulder. Opening the fastener, I unhook myself from my lifeline but grab hold of the strap so I don't slip and fall. A few seconds later, Carl dips down lower on the far side of the house, flying through the thick red smoke. Once we break through, I step off the skid while the aircraft streaks along 25 feet above ground at 40 miles an hour. Falling through the air, I hold my rifle close to my body and tuck in my legs, saying a prayer that this next stage of my plan works as well as the last one. Sean Hall ran over to Ken Cage lying on the floor near the open front door and helped him back to his feet. As the two men began running for the rear of the property, Hall shouted into his walkie-talkie,
"Scott and Randy, on me! The rest of you, buy us some time till I get the cops here. I'm going to get the principal into Citadel 2. Collapse on that location as you fall back."
Citadel 2 was Hall's code name for the second floor of the pool house, a fallback position he'd set up in case of an attack on the principal or his family at home. Hall knew Charlotte was in the pool house, so it wasn't an optimal destination, but he also knew it was the last place the men attacking from the front of the property would be able to check. It was all about delaying now, delaying Gentry and his crew from getting to the boss. Hall had been in the LAPD, and he knew they'd be surrounding this place in moments, and he assumed Gentry didn't want to get rolled up by local cops, so his helicopter would have to come back to pick him up in a matter of moments. This was going to be a waiting game, and Hall thought getting Cage as far from Gentry as possible was his best course of action.
"Take Maya," Verdun shouted from behind him. "Maya stays with Cage."
Roxana Vaduva was grabbed roughly by one of Hall's men and dragged through the house. She dropped the cord she'd cut earlier from around her wrists, then began pulling and swinging at the man, forcing her back through the house. She slowed him, and this slowed the entire entourage, but within 20 seconds, they were at the back door. Sean Hall was surprised to see a dense cloud of red smoke on the patio, partially obscuring his view. He took this to mean that attackers were coming from that direction, too, but he kept advancing, knowing that turning around and running back towards the stairs, towards the source of incoming gunfire, would be a bad idea, and hunkering down here on the ground floor would only help Gentry locate Cage sooner. No, he would try to use the smoke to stay hidden from anyone out here, and he'd shoot anything that moved. Cage, on the other hand, stopped his forward advance in the kitchen when he saw the red cloud at the sliding glass door. Hall screamed at him, pulled on him, just like his men did to Maya 10 feet behind. Soon, they were all in the smoke, running across the patio, turning right so they didn't stumble into the pool, finally bursting out into clear air by the two rectangular koi ponds. They ran on. Hall was first to the door to the pool house. He pushed Cage into his living room and kept his gun up high as they raced upstairs. I kneel in the shallow end of the pool now, my eyes and the top of my head the only parts of me visible while I watch Cage, Roxana, and three other men enter the pool house 50 feet away. They're facing away from me. They have no idea I've just dropped from the sky into the swimming pool, and they also have no idea that they've been spotted. The pool jump seemed like a good idea when we drew it up, but when I crashed into the water, the weight of my gear sent me to the bottom of the deep end. I was aiming for the shallow end, naturally, but mistimed my jump because of the smoke, so I shot right to the bottom and remained there. Movement of any kind was nearly impossible, but I had been prepared to dump equipment if necessary, so I quickly removed my AK and my chest rig, leaving on my utility belt and my small canvas hip pack. Now I'm armed only with my Glock 19 pistol and the suppressed 22 caliber Walther pistol. I have a spare mag for the Glock and a fixed blade knife. I wipe water from my eyes and speak into my mic, which, thankfully, is fully waterproof.
You guys breached yet?
Negative, Rodney says. We're at the front door now, about to flashbang our way in.
Roger that, I say.
Primary target has retreated into the pool house with three hostiles and one friendly.
Understood. We'll link up with you when able.
I hear the flashbangs go off in the house, and then I hear an unreal amount of gunfire. I don't know how long it will take my crew to make their way back here, so I decide I'll have to hit the pool house alone. I stand up fully in the pool, pull a smoke grenade from my belt, yank the pin, and hurl it closer to the pool house, hoping to cover my approach in more of the red obscurant. And then I begin wading forward. I'm down a gun, I'm alone, I'm outnumbered, and I know the cops are closing in. Nothing about this is optimal, but time is not on my side. So, I'll have to make it work.
Sean Hall left his two men behind him covering Maya and the director while he cleared the upstairs. He had them stop and wait on the landing between the floors while he moved up, checking the two bedrooms, his small office and two bathrooms along with the larger of the closets. Only once he was certain no one was lying in wait up there did he call down to his men for his boss and the hostage to be brought up.
Cage was hyperventilating, the terror evident from his breathing, his wild eyes, and the sweat that covered his pink, bald head. Hall rushed him into the back corner of the rear bedroom.
"You stay in here with Maya," Hall said.
He normally was deferential to his boss, but now that Cage's life, as well as his own, was on the line, Hall was the alpha. The former Navy SEAL felt all the terror right now that his protectee's face displayed. This gray man seemed to be some sort of unstoppable force, and unlike Verdorn, Hall had no wish to get a closer look at him. But his military training had taught him how to compartmentalize his fear and to remain on task, so he was all business now.
"Where are you going?"
Cage asked nervously as Hall started for the door.
"Not far. I'll be at the top of the stairs with my men. We just have to hold Gentry and the others back. How long will it take for the cops to get here?"
Sean knew beat cops would already be swarming over the lower part of the Hollywood Hills, converging on the gunfire, and he could hear air cover overhead. But as for when SWAT would actually hit the property, he couldn't be sure.
"It might be a half hour. They'll want to know what they're getting into, but Gentry won't want to get caught in the cordon already sealing off the streets. If he doesn't find you in the big house, he'll probably bug out. We delay him until that happens."
Hall hoped this all to be true, but he wasn't certain. He pushed Maya to Cage, and the shorter man took her in his grasp, wrapping an arm around her neck.
"Give me a gun," the director demanded now.
Hall had one firearm on him, just like his two other security men. He wasn't giving Cage his gun. Instead, he reached into his pocket and pulled out a folding knife with a 4-inch blade. He opened it and handed it to his boss. Then he turned and left the room, heading back for the hallway near the stairs. His two men, Scott and Randy, were there and covering down the stairs. Randy had been shot, apparently back at the front entrance to the house, but his arm wound looked manageable. Hall pulled his walkie-talkie, unsure how many of his men or Verdorn's men were left.
"Principal is secure at Secondary Citadel."
He then clipped the radio back on his belt and grabbed his phone from his pocket. At the top of the stairs, he typed a short text to Charlotte. "Wherever you are, find cover. It will be over soon." Charlotte Cage was on the ground floor of the pool house, hiding in the utility room right below her father. She lay flat on her stomach behind three surfboards propped up against the wall, and she tried not to scream in terror as gunfire echoed around the entire property. She had no idea what was going on here, but she was too scared to run for the back door, and she didn't know where she would go if she did. She held her phone in her hands and saw the text from Sean when it lit up the screen. She struggled to type out a reply, but she finally managed to do so. "I'm in the utility room, hiding. Please help." Charlotte put the phone on the floor by her face, then closed her eyes tight, willing this to end. Dr. Claudia Riesling ran through Juliet's bedroom on the second floor because she'd seen a window there that overlooked thick hillside foliage. Her plan was to climb down into the bushes and escape the property before it was too late. If she could just get to the street, she told herself, she could call an Uber and, with luck, she could get the hell out of here before the police stopped her to see how she was involved in all this. She knew the threat anyone around would face when the police rained down on this property. The consortium would be uncovered, and, if she was here at the time, she'd be tied to it. This event would be too high profile for Cage's people to cover up. Of this, she felt certain. Anyone involved here who survived the attack of the gray man would be heading to prison. She had a plan of sorts. She would leave the country. Riesling held bank accounts in Panama and Antigua and Malta, and she knew which countries would and would not extradite her back to the United States. Fleeing America would not be ideal for her, but she knew the consortium itself would live on after this, even without Cage and his minions here. It was just too large. There was too much money to be made. And they would always need someone with her skills. The American woman dropped to the ground from the second-story window, turning her ankle slightly when she landed. She limped along the western side of the property, holding on to branches to keep from tumbling down the steep decline. She made her way to the 6-foot-high stone fence surrounding the 2 acres, and then she began climbing. Jaco Verdorn moved backwards through the kitchen, firing round after round from his HK back into the entry hall as he retreated. Lutz was with him, firing his rifle, and Diker staggered along as well, though the vicious and bloody wound to his arm was occupying most of his attention. Another of Hall's men had been killed, but one made it upstairs, and from the sound of gunfire it seemed to Yako like one of the raiders had gone up there to root him out. That left at least two enemy down here, and Verdun found himself still hoping to get Gentry in his sights. A man with a rifle spun into the doorway from the dining room to the kitchen, and Yako fired over and over, hitting his target in the upper chest and head. The man dropped flat onto the tile floor, but a second attacker appeared behind him, and he shot Diker in the stomach at a range of 20 feet. Diker dropped dead in the kitchen, and Lutz returned fire, sending the enemy to cover. Yako dumped rounds from his VP-9 until he ran dry, then reloaded his empty pistol. As he did this, he screamed to Lutz,
"Lead them through the house! You need to keep them occupied until LAPD breaches! I'm heading to the Citadel!"
"Right, sir,"
Lutz said. And as he took off for the hall to the rear of the home, Verdun ran for the back door. Like Hall, the South African was surprised to see the smoke here, but he didn't expect to find any opposition, because Hall had just radioed that he and the others had made it to the pool house.
I'm out of the swimming pool now, water rushing from my boots as I begin moving across the patio, stepping into the smoke with my pistol out in front of me. I make it no more than a few steps before I hear Kareem through my earpiece.
AJ is dead. Repeat, AJ is KIA.
Shit. The gunfire from the house behind me continues, and I don't know how many enemy are still fighting there, but I try to push everything out of my mind so I can focus on my objective. The slight morning breeze has moved the smoke in all directions. I can't see my hand in front of my face. Behind me, I hear a cacophony of police sirens, but I'm not overly worried about being caught by the cops just yet. There is no way in hell the LAPD is going to race into this maelstrom without knowing what the hell they're up against. They'll block roads, they'll fly helicopters overhead, they'll do what they can to get civilians out of the line of fire. SWAT trucks will arrive and a plan will be drawn up, and only then will they begin rooting out the shooters. No, I'm not worried about the cops. The bad guys with guns here on the property are so much more concerning right now. I start to emerge from the thick obscurant, and I catch a glimpse of a pair of rectangular pools in the patio in front of me before more smoke whirls across my face. I try to pick up my pace, but only go a pair of steps before I feel an incredible impact on my right side. It's a body. Someone running has slammed into me at speed, and I go airborne, my weapon tumbling from my hands. I hit the cut stone patio surface, knocking the wind out of me, and I try to reach my pack behind me to retrieve the backup pistol I have there. But before I do, I feel a hand grab me by the leg. I kick free but realize the man who crashed into me is on the ground in the smoke close by. And then I see the knife, a glint of steel shining through a break in the red cloud, slashing in my direction. He misses, but he has the advantage. This man has speed, violence of action. There's a weapon in his hand while I'm still fumbling with my backpack. In my world, we call my situation a deficit of initiative, but that's just a fancy way of saying this asshole got the drop on me, so now I'm fucked. I sense more than see him lunging at me through the thick cloud, and I roll out of the way. The blade strikes the stone, and I launch up to my waterlogged boots. The man disappears in the red cloud, then reappears just as suddenly. He's on me again as I pull the fixed blade knife from my belt. He slashes to the right, cuts into my tunic at my ribcage, and I feel a hot sting. I retreat back a few steps and lose sight of him again. I'm bleeding. The cut feels long, but not deep. Knife fights on TV are a joke. In the real world, there is no dancing around, swinging the blade left and right, or stabbing straight down from the sky. Not by anyone who knows what the hell they are doing. The knife fights I've been in are a horror show. A combatant diving forward and jabbing straight out towards the midsection, over and over, 3 or 4 times a second if he's fast. The attacks are difficult to defend against. The person defending does what he can to scramble back, falling backwards or juking to the side. But it's not like Hollywood, where the guy on the receiving end has time to parry with a thoughtful move and then counterattack. If you fight with a knife, you are going to get cut. By your enemy or by yourself, you are going to get cut. More than once. I get cut more than once.
I see his arm thrust out again through the cloud, and this time the blade nicks me on the right forearm. I feel a second hot sting and hear the blade tip slicing the flesh. The cut is 2 inches from the muscles that make some of my fingers work, so it's very nearly a debilitating wound, but his awkward jab presents me with an opportunity. I lunge low with my own knife, hitting him in the back of the hand and slicing it open with a 4-inch gash. He screams, steps back, and we lose each other in the swirling red cloud for a moment again. Smoke wafts over from the back doors of the mansion and spews from the grenade between the koi ponds, and the breeze seems to churn it around us. I'm breathing hard, not moving, my back to the shallow end of the swimming pool behind me. Where is he? From somewhere in the red cloud around me, I hear him.
I bloody love my job, gentry.
Fucking Yakko. He appears on my right, closing fast, and in a desperate attempt to avoid getting slashed, I fall backwards onto the stone. He lands on me, and we're wrestling and swinging and ducking now. Two desperate men using all their strength, all their training and cunning, to try both to kill the other and to avoid being killed. I'm on my back when I drive a knee up into his crotch and jab with my knife, stabbing him in the right forearm. Then I roll again as he dives down towards me, smoke swirling around his now visible form. Soon we find ourselves with me holding the wrist that's holding his knife, and him holding the wrist that's holding my knife. I roll to my right with all my strength, and we tumble together in the shallow end of the swimming pool. I land on my back on the upper step, only a foot deep. But Yakko's on top of me. He still has my knife hand tight at the wrist. His knife is pointed right over my heart, and I use all the strength in my body to keep it from plunging straight down. By being above me, with the weight of his body over his knife hand, I realize that he has leverage I don't possess.
Got you, gentry!
He shouts, and I think he may be right. The knife tip disappears into the water, inches away from my heart now. Smoke wafts over us, obscuring my view of the bald-headed man leaning over me, lying on his knife to drive it down while I hold it up with a weakening left arm. I find myself hoping Kareem and Rodney will appear above us and save me, but not for long. I need a new strategy, and hope definitely isn't it. I realize what I have to do now, and I don't love it, but it's my only play. I drop my knife in my right hand, surprising him, then spin my wrist down, deeper into the water on my right, whipping out of his grasp. The hand is unarmed now, but I bring it up to grab the knife above my heart. With my left hand, I let go now, reach down to my left side, and fumble with my pack there. Yakko senses that I'm making some sort of a move, so he throws his entire body onto the arm holding the knife. I'm about to get stabbed, and I know it. I shift my body to the right, just a few inches, and Yakko's cold steel connects with the skin on my left shoulder, just below the clavicle. The blade plunges into me, hilt deep, and I scream in pain. And then I swivel my left hand out of the pack and shoot him on the right side of his midsection, at contact distance, with my suppressed Walther 22. He lurches back in surprise, and I take the opportunity to scramble back myself. His knife is still stuck all the way into my shoulder, so I disarmed him, but I paid one hell of a price to do so. My left arm hangs low to my side now. I can't lift it to fire the pistol again. The bullet I shot him with is small and slow, one of the least powerful rounds one can use. I haven't killed him, but I'm sure I've hurt him and put a tiny bit of lead a few inches into his intestines. He starts to stand, and I try to do the same, but my left arm still won't cooperate. But my right arm is fine. I reach down one more step into the pool, retrieve the knife I dropped there seconds ago, heft it as I launch to my feet out of the water, and dive on him at the edge of the pool. I land on him fully, and the knife sinks into his chest, hilt deep. I push myself off him and sit on the top step. The smoke blows away enough to see him there on the patio, his legs dangling down into the water. His face ashen and his eyes wide with bewilderment. He just lies on his back, staring skyward. Still love your job, Yakko? He coughs up blood that stains his face, then runs down to his white shirt and crimson tie, trickles into the pool, and reddens the water around him, much like the last wisps of the smoke grenades redden the air around us. He dies lying next to me without saying a word. And I pull myself up to my feet
and step out of the pool. I walk over to him and kick him over towards the edge, and he falls into the water and begins floating away, face down. The smoke clears finally, and I regard the knife sticking out of my shoulder. I have to leave it there for now, otherwise it will only bleed more. I switch the Walther to my right hand and begin again for the pool house. Suddenly I'm aware that the gunfire from the main house has stopped.
Rodney, report status.
House is clear. I'm hit. Not life-threatening. I've linked up with Kareem. We're coming over to the pool house.
The door is just feet in front of me now. Remain outside. Watch for squirters.
No reason for you to breach alone, Harry.
But he's wrong. There is a reason.
Say again, hold positions on the patio and provide cover.
Rodney is obviously confused by this, but he's a good soldier.
Understood. Be careful in there.
Dr. Claudia Riesling had called the Uber when she was still hidden in the trees on the hillside, and then she'd waited until the app told her it was less than a minute away before struggling over a fence and out onto the street. The road in front of her was empty other than parked cars. Police sirens wailed lower on the hill, but she still didn't think there was any law enforcement presence up here just yet. There was an LAPD helicopter nearby. She was very familiar with the sound, and farther away she heard what might have been a news chopper. She didn't see either of the aircraft directly above her, so she straightened out her clothes, put her phone in her purse, and walked out into the winding two-lane road, just as a gray Toyota Camry pulled around a tight hillside turn and stopped 20 feet in front of her. A woman sat behind the wheel. Riesling hadn't bothered to look on the app to see the driver or the car, but she stepped to the back door, opened it, and climbed in. The woman just turned back to her and stared. Riesling said,
"The Four Seasons, Beverly Hills. You got that right. What's your name?"
the woman asked, her voice accented, like many Uber drivers here in L.A.
"Claudia, let's go."
The woman behind the wheel reached for her purse, fumbled in it a moment.
"Don't you hear the shooting going on down the street? I said let's go,"
Riesling demanded. Soon the red-haired woman began driving forward, towards the sound of gunfire, not away from it.
"Turn around! What the hell are you doing?"
Riesling asked.
"You know, forget it. I'll walk. Pull over now."
But the Camry only picked up speed on the winding road. Dr. Riesling shouted with all the authority she could muster,
"Pull over!"
She reached for the door handle, but the driver slammed hard on the brakes, sending the psychologist forward. Claudia's face smacked the headrest in front of her, hard. Dazed, she held her hand to her bloody nose and started cursing her driver, but only until the back door opened next to her. The driver reached in, grabbed Dr. Claudia Riesling by her sweater, and shoved her down onto her back. Riesling brought her hands up to protect her face, but a large kitchen knife was pressed against her throat. The younger woman leaned over her through the open door. In an accent Claudia suddenly realized was Central European, perhaps Romanian, she said,
"You're not going anywhere, bitch."
Talisa Corbu pulled the woman she recognized from the LinkedIn page of Dr. Claudia Riesling out of the car, and soon both women walked down the hill along Jovanita Canyon Drive. I clear the downstairs of the pool house and find a young girl hiding on the ground floor in the back. She's terrified, crying, and dressed in a wetsuit, which seems like a very strange thing for a young sex trafficking victim to be wearing. I say nothing to her at first, only help her up to her feet and walk her back down the hall towards the living room and the staircase there, because I know now Cage and the others are on the second floor. I motion to the front door with my head, my gun still pointed at the staircase. When she doesn't move, I say, "Do you speak English?" She nods, her voice is meek. Staring at the dagger hilt jutting from my blood-drenched left shoulder, she says,
"Yes, sir."
She's clearly American, probably 15 or 16, and this confuses me. What are you doing here?
"I live here."
Then she says,
"Are you going to kill my dad?"
Cage's child. She's so like the girls I saw along the pipeline that I can't even process it. How could these people, Cage and the others in the consortium, be so unspeakably evil when they themselves have children? I don't ponder this for long. Instead, I answer the girl as truthfully as I can. I'm just here to make things better. That's true, isn't it?
Please, she implores. Don't hurt him.
I smile a little, but I guess it must look sinister to her, seeing who I am and what I'm smack dab in the middle of. My smile fades as this occurs to me, and then I say, I need you to run out that front door. There is no one out there who will hurt you, I promise. Into my earpiece, I say, I got one, green, coming out the front. A green is a non-combatant, not a friendly, a blue, or an enemy, a red. I wait for the reply from Rodney. Understood, one green out the front door of the pool house. Do we detain? Negative. Just make sure she gets clear. Roger that. Rodney will probably think this little girl is another sex slave, like the hundreds he's rescued in his life. This realization only serves to make me want to kill her daddy so much more. But I can't. Can I? Go ahead, I say to her. Out the door. Fresh tears fill her eyes, and I know she'll never be the same. It's a shame, but her tears aren't going to stop me from doing what I came here to do to her father.
Why?
She asks, now watching blood drip from my left fingertips onto the floor. She thinks I'm a monster. I see that in her eyes. She doesn't know that her own father is the monster. Maybe she will soon, or maybe this will all be swept under the rug somehow, but I don't have time to walk her through Kenneth Cage's crimes. So I don't answer. I swing my gun towards her now, shifting it towards the front door, and soon she leaves, sobbing all the way. When the door closes behind her, I turn my attention to the staircase. Cage is up there, I can feel it. He's with Roxana, and it all ends here. With my Walther aimed up the stairs, I begin ascending. There is a mirror on the landing that gives me a narrow view to the second floor, and my eyes are on it, but I can't see anyone above. I only make it halfway to the landing when I hear a man up there speak. Gentry? I stop, take a few steps backwards till I'm on the ground floor again. I don't recognize the voice.
Who's that?
I'm Cage's bodyguard. I sniff out a little laugh. I hope you've updated your resume. I resume my climb, slowly and carefully, my weapon high in front of me.
Look, man,
he says from above, and I stop again. There's three of us up here, all armed and well-trained.
Thanks for the heads up. I'm liking my odds, though.
And we're all ready for you. You can turn around now, get out of here, and we won't come looking.
If you were ready for me, you wouldn't be giving me that option, would you?
I hear the man sigh all the way down here. Then he says, Look, bro, I've had enough. I don't want to die for this shit. Let's just call a truce. We stay up here, you leave. I can send the girl down to you, unharmed. Roxana isn't unharmed, of this I'm certain. Before I respond, I hear a man shout out from another room upstairs.
What the fuck are you doing, Sean?
I don't recognize this voice either, but I know exactly who it is.
Hi, Ken. Just met your daughter.
She's going to miss you. There is no response.
I met your man Yako, too. By the way, you might want to get that pool out there professionally cleaned.
The bodyguard shouts down again.
If you won't knock it off, Gentry, we will kill you.
I back off the stairs, my right hand holding the Walther because of the knife still sticking out of my left shoulder. Through a grimace of pain, I say,
I love your optimism, Sean.
It's desperation, dude.
And that's exactly what I hear in his voice now. Then he screams out, plaintive and terrified.
What are you? A hero? A fucking saint? We aren't all like that, you know? Some of us out here are just trying to make a living.
I kneel down, searching for a target in the mirror's reflection. While doing this, I say,
I had a mentor, and he had a thing he used to tell me. Every saint has a past, and every sinner has a future.
For several seconds, I hear nothing, nor do I see anything through the reflection. Softly, Sean says,
I like that.
I think he's right above me, so I can fire into the ceiling and, with a little luck, get some 22 rounds on this guy. But I don't know where Roxana is, so I decide that I'll have to ascend the stairs to verify my targets. But just as I begin to move, he says,
Look.
What do you say I tell my guys to toss their weapons, I do the same, and you let us walk out of here?
I'd like to shoot this guy. I imagine that the remorse he seems to be feeling now only comes after getting busted protecting an evil man, and I don't have any respect for that type of self-development. But three armed men on the second floor are slowing down my approach to my target.
Anybody else up there, other than Cage and Maya?
No, sir. I swear to God.
Is Cage armed?
A little folding knife, that's it.
All right. You boys come down slowly, and nobody will fire on you. After a pause, the man says,
I'm trusting you to do the right thing here, Gentry.
Ditto. You step onto that landing empty-handed, or I drop you where you stand. Got it? I hear the other man again, the one I take for Cage.
Sean, I'll double your salary. I'll double it. And no hard feelings, swear to God. Just hold out till the cops come. Do your job protecting me, and I'll double... Fuck it, I'll triple your salary. Permanently.
Hall speaks to me, not to Cage. He just says,
This fucking guy, right?
But I respond, That's a lot of dough, Sean. It's gotta be tempting. It's your call. The squadron of LAPD helicopters flying overhead nearly drowns out his soft response.
I'm just a surfer, bro. I don't need much, but I need my life.
Cage shouts,
Sean! Sean!
I hear Sean's weapon thud on the carpeted floor right above my head, and then he steps in front of the mirror. He's directly above me, but I don't shoot the ceiling. Two more men come into view, their hands raised. One has blood smeared on his face, and more blood stains the sleeve of tats on his right arm. All three men walk downstairs, past my position. Sean, the last of the three, looks at me as he passes. He nods in cool appreciation, then forces a smile as he says, Maybe we grab a beer when you're done. I look away, back to the staircase.
Why would I do that? You're still a piece of shit. I'd love to be your karma, but I know it will catch up to you someday.
Sean looks downcast, and then he turns away and walks towards the door behind his men. I call over the radio.
Three coming out. Don't fire unless they pose a threat.
Rodney says,
Roger, be advised. Cops have blocked off the roads out front, but they haven't moved on the property. Helos in the air all around. Got a call from Carl. He was forced to land at a heliport in Hollywood. The LAPD will have him in custody by now.
Okay, I say. You boys try to get clear. I'll wrap up here.
Kareem answers now.
We're not going anywhere, Harry. We've got your back.
Sean!
Cage calls out again from upstairs.
Come on, Sean!
But I am the one who answers. He's gone. It's alone time for you and me, Kenny.
Look, Gentry, I can...
Yeah, I interrupt. You can make me a rich man, I know. But I don't need money. I just need Roxana. If you don't hurt her, I'll let you live.
He doesn't respond. I step over to the kitchen, open the freezer, and retrieve a massive frosty bottle of Grey Goose vodka. I bite the glass and cork lid off, then pour some on my bloody shoulder, coating my wet tunic, my wound, and the hilt of the dagger protruding there. Vodka runs down my arm and drips with blood from my fingertips. Then I recap the bottle with my mouth and head up the stairs, the pistol in front of me, and the vodka down to the side now in my nearly non-compliant left hand. On the second floor, I see blood on the carpet, obviously where the wounded bodyguard had been standing. Cage's voice came from a back room, so I walk up the hall, push in the door slowly, and find him standing there, with Roxana tight against his chest. There's a knife to her throat. I look at her. The veins in her throat pulsate. Her breathing is fast and shallow. It's going to be okay, I say, and I actually believe it now. She doesn't respond. I point the Walther at Cage's face with my right hand. My bloody left shoulder is screaming at me now. I say, Let her go, or you will die right now. He holds the knife against her carotid, but I just aim in carefully. Dude, you are a dozen feet away. Do you really think I can't put a bullet in your eye socket if I want?
I'll kill her.
Nope. You'll drop like a sack of wet sand. Cage gets it. The only chance he has is to comply. He lowers the knife and lets it fall to the floor. He raises his hands slowly into the air. Roxana, I say. There are men outside. They'll help you. Go to them. She seems utterly bewildered to be alive as she heads for the stairs, still in shock. As she passes, she stares at the knife sticking out of me and the left half of my body, which by now is all covered in blood. With my pistol on Cage's face, I transmit to the guys, Blue coming out, Talissa's sister, protect her.
Hell fucking yeah,
Rodney says. Cage looks at me, at the gun, at the massive bottle of Grey Goose swinging from my left hand. He says,
You're after the wrong guy.
I raise an eyebrow.
This ought to be good.
I helped the process, obviously, but I don't do it myself. Yako was the brains. I just do the financing, stuff like that.
So what you're saying is, you are the money guy for a massive consortium of sex traffickers. That's your defense.
You promised you wouldn't kill me.
I laugh a little, but say nothing. He continues. Last year, we grossed $10.3 billion. Sounds like a lot, but this is a $150 billion a year industry. I'm just a small player, but I know names, Gentry. I know names and locations. I can get you steered towards the big fish. You want that, right? That wasn't just about Maya. This was about you ending this whole thing, wasn't it?
I say nothing. Just glance out a second-story window. I see Roxana run past Rodney, and then Kareem appears, limping, and he wraps an arm around her and begins escorting her up the driveway. Within seconds, he's leaning on her, and she is the one helping him along. Both surviving members of the Manila team are hurt now, but the aches and pains that come from doing this kind of shit at their age are going to only get worse. Cage keeps talking.
I can help you. I feel terrible about what we've done. I always have. Always wanted out of it. It's just, shit, just got out of hand. Believe me, Gentry, I'm so sorry.
I sigh a little, and I force my left hand up to my face so I can bite the lid off the vodka bottle. I take a swig of the alcohol. It's ice cold, and it's good going down. I say,
One thing I've noticed in this line of work... Nobody is sorry when they are doing what they do. But everyone seems so fucking sorry when I show up to make them pay for it. What do you suppose that's about, Kenny?
He knows there's nothing he can say that will stop me from doing whatever it is I want to do, but he tries anyway.
Listen, I have an arrangement with the government. I help them. Intel on terrorists, mostly. I've saved a lot of lives. Just right now, I'm working on something that's going to be huge.
I sigh a little.
And that's my dilemma, Ken. If I kill you, then I'm going to make some enemies that I can't afford to make. I'll be hunted down and assassinated by the American government.
A slight look of surprise flickers on his face.
Then you'll let me go?
He asks.
I nod. I will. Not because I want to. But because I have to. I'm egging him on now, hoping to get more bravado out of him.
He nods up and down vehemently.
So, you know, you understand. I do a hell of a lot of good for this country. I'm a patriot.
I feel my jaw clench, and then I say, Like I said, I can't kill you, because then they would kill me. I give him a little wink. But I bet they'd only get really mad at me if I fucked you up for life. With a smile, I say, and I'm used to them being mad at me. Cage's bravado is slow to drift away, but it drains from his face, finally, and he stammers,
What?
I aim quickly and fire. I'm not fucking around, and I shoot Cage in the testicles so that he's not fucking around either. He screams bloody murder, even more than I'd expected, and then he drops and flails on the floor in shock and agony.
I walk over to him and pour Grey Goose over the hands covering his bloody crotch. Then I drop the bottle on the floor next to him. Vodka pours from it. Put that on your junk. It takes Cage another 5 seconds before he takes the bottle, and then he rolls over onto his stomach, writhing around on the cold glass like he's humping it.
Kill me! Just kill me!
He screams. I kneel next to him and speak in a slow and measured tone. The people you assist in the government, they are the ones who saved your miserable life today. You need to go back to work for them with the exact same intensity and effort as before. Or you know what will happen.
Kill me now, you sick son of a bitch!
I'll never kill you. I'll just return and take away more of what you hold dear. This time, it's your manhood. Next time, I see a framed portrait of Cage with his family in the bedroom. It's lying on the floor, the glass broken. I set it up next to where he's writhing. Next time, who knows what I'll take from you. I'm bluffing. His wife is probably in on it, but I'm not a detective, so I don't know, and I would never harm anyone's kids. And now, when I look into Cage's eyes, I realize he believes I will do what I say I'll do. He'll comply. He'll keep working for the agency with or without functioning balls. I rise to my feet again. Keep the vodka on your nuts till the paramedics come. It will slow the bleeding. I turn and head for the stairs. Into my mic, I say, I'm coming out the front. Roger that, Rodney responds. A few seconds later, I meet him by the pool. He's been shot through the thigh. The round went through and through, but he's already bandaged it tightly. He looks me over. Dude, your shoulder. I turn and stare at the knife there. I hadn't noticed. Rodney laughs. Better leave it in till you get to a hospital. What happened in there? Kareem asks. I let Cage live. Why would you leave him alive? Trust me, I took all the fun out of it for him. Kareem sits on a planter by the back door. Wish the cops would hurry the hell up. Rodney lowers to the ground next to him. Both men look utterly smoked. But I don't sit. Guys, I've got to try and run. Both older men nod, but Rodney says, Get out of here, brother. Good fighting with you. We'll see you around. Kareem adds, Yeah, in the yard at Pelican Bay. All three of us laugh at this. It's the only Supermax prison in California. And the only reason we're laughing is that, right now, none of us really gives a shit. We did our jobs today, and we know what we did was righteous. When LAPD gets here, I say, tell them to send a paramedic to the second floor of the pool house. There's a wounded man, an innocent, and he needs help. What the hell do you mean, innocent? I shrug. I don't make the rules, I just follow them. I pause, then say, sometimes. 3 minutes after this, I'm climbing up a steep incline to a street a block north and 100 feet higher up the hill. My left arm useless at my side. I've pulled my mask down over my face, so if I run into anyone dumb enough to be out on the street, I'm going to look pretty scary, but at least the TV choppers above won't show my mug on the evening news. I make a turn and see a gaggle of police cars 25 yards ahead. I can just make out Roxana there, standing next to a squad car with two other women. I recognize Talissa by her bright red hair, and by the fact that she and her sister embrace so hard, it looks like they are trying to crush each other. I don't know who the other woman is, but after several seconds, Roxana turns to her and punches her in the face, dropping her to the ground. I suddenly have no doubts about her identity. A cop on the bullhorn tells me to drop to my knees on the street, but I just turn away from the roadblock and begin walking back down the hill. The guy keeps shouting at me, but I'm unconcerned. I guess it's possible I'll be arrested by the local 5-0, but I have a sinking suspicion I won't. You're the gray man. You can just slip away, I tell myself. But I'm wrong. A pair of vans appears around a turn below me on the road, and I'm sure they've already crossed a police line to make it this high up on the hill. As they approach, I stop, look at a densely wooded property next to me, and consider making a run for it. But I don't.
Instead, I just let out a long, tired sigh. The vans stop alongside me, and the side door of the closest one slides open. Zach Hightower looks me over, up and down.
You look like shit, kid.
He sees the hilt protruding from just below my collarbone.
But on the bright side, looks like you won a free knife.
I don't speak. I just climb into the back of the van and it begins rolling off. Armed men all around search and cuff me while Zach looks on. When they're finished, he reaches over to me and puts his hand around my back. Hightower knows I keep a handcuff key secreted under a belt loop, so he grabs it, then tosses it out of the van. He pulls out his phone as we start driving off.
Sir, I've got him. No trouble, but half of Hollywood is on fire.
He waits a moment, then says,
Yes, sir.
Zach holds the phone to my ear. I know it's Hanley. I'm right. He says,
Subtle, Violator. Real subtle.
I just look out the window. He adds,
I want to break your fucking neck.
Get in line, boss.
Is he alive?
He is.
Okay.
I think that's the end of it, but what he says next surprises me.
Court, here's what I'm prepared to do. This isn't a negotiation. This is not my opening offer. You get what you get, and what you get is all you get.
I'm listening.
We'll reach out quietly to all the federal law enforcement agencies along the route of the pipeline. Not the state or regional or municipal agencies, but the big guys, at the highest level.
I start to speak, but he cuts me off.
We'll pass on any information Talissa Corbu gives us, and then we'll tell these agencies that we'll be checking back to see if the pipeline is shut down and the women safely recovered.
I think there's more coming, but then he says nothing. I reply with,
That's it? That's it. You are too precious a commodity for me to let you run around the world saving individual girls. The next job I have for you, frankly, kid, it's bigger than that.
What about Kareem and Rodney and Carl?
I assume those are the men who helped you and survived?
Yeah.
The agency will assist them. We'll get them out of custody, he adds. Eventually. Quietly.
Hanley ends the call before I can put up any fight, and Hightower takes the phone from my ear, disconnects it, and drops it back in his bag. The ground branch guy called Teddy pulls the knife out of me. I scream in agony, but he knows what he's doing, and instantly he's cleaning and then bandaging my shoulder, while another guy pours antiseptic on my arm and rib wounds. Chris Travers reaches out from behind me and gives me a squeeze on my good shoulder, then leans forward.
We gotta stop meeting like this, bro.
I don't reply. We pass through a police line unmolested, then leave the Hollywood Hills a few minutes later. Soon I can tell we're heading towards the airport.
What's our destination, Zach?
There's an agency citation waiting for us at LAX. We'll land at Andrews around 2100 hours. Hanley's gonna want you wheels up pretty shortly after that, so you'll need to be treated on the way. Something big's brewing.
I'd put my head in my hands if my hands weren't cuffed behind my back. Instead, I just let my head hang down to my chest. To the other guys, it may look like it's exhaustion, frustration, disappointment. They'd be right about that. I'm feeling all these things. But they'd be wrong if they thought it was a sign I was giving up. Fuck no. I'm just getting started. Zach misinterprets my demeanor.
It's all right, kid. You kicked ass.
He slaps me on the back, and I hate when he does this.
You'll be off killing bozos again before you know it.
I'm too tired to give Zach a fuck you, so I just sit here, and I think about this entire damn thing. I hope Kareem and Rodney and Carl are taken care of by the agency. I hope Talissa and Roxana and the other girls from the ranch can all go back to their lives, putting this behind them. I hope Liliana made it back to Moldova safely, and I hope the 22 women and girls sold into bondage in Italy can be found and rescued. All these people need so much help, but I can't help them. I can't help any of them. All I can do is hope. I close my eyes and lean my head back now. Men continue to treat my wounds as I sit there. Hope isn't a strategy, but sometimes it's all you've got.
This has been an Audible Studios production of 1 Minute Out, Gray Man, Book 9. Written by Mark Graney, performed by Jay Snyder. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer Chris Sacco. Copyright 2020 by Mark Graney Books, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.